Welcome back to another episode of the Legendary Life Podcast. I'm your host, Ted Rice, and this is the show that's all about taking your health, body, and life to the next level. Today's episode is actually a bit of a bonus. I have Dr. Joel Seidman back on the podcast because after our first conversation, which was about 50 minutes long, I realized, wow, I feel like that was such a tease. There are so many unanswered questions in my mind. I can only imagine what you may be thinking. So I got him right back on to get deeper into this conversation about eccentric isometrics, how to apply it, and much, much more. In fact, I'm going to be asking Joel to come back on several times because he is just a wealth of information. In fact, I'll say it like this. There are so many people out there who claim to be biohackers and they have this very science-y sounding approach to exercise or optimizing the mental and physical performance of the human body. Joel is a guy who I would consider that. Now, he doesn't call himself that, but I feel like he's on the cutting edge of strength training, of not only like just building muscles and strength, but also improving the function of the human body. Now, why is that important? Well, because if you want to be playing tennis when you're 70 years old without being in tremendous pain or going through knee replacements or hip replacements or arthroscopic surgery on torn labrums in your shoulder or rotator cuff tears, anything like that, then this is critical information. So I had him back on the show. If you haven't heard the first part of Strength Training Secrets with Dr. Joel Seidman, go to part one because this is a continuation of what our conversation was about in round one. And as I said, I can't wait to have him back. Also, make sure you check out his website, advancedhumanperformance.com. And I have a bit of an update to make. I've tried his foot and ankle training manual. And if you are having balance issues, if you are having plantar fasciitis type of issues, if you're having knee problems or hip problems, and you're a runner or you do some type of endurance activity or perhaps not getting the best results from your leg training, you've got to check out his foot and ankle training manual. It is fantastic. I'm using the techniques in there with myself, with my clients who have knee problems or hip problems. I'm getting great results, and it's just an amazing resource of information. You can find that and more at advancedhumanperformance.com. Now let's get to Dr. Joel Seidman's second interview, Strength Training Secrets, Part 2. Dr. Joel Seidman, welcome back to the Legendary Life Podcast.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me on again so soon.
Absolutely. Well, we had our first conversation. The listeners have already heard it, and I felt like there were so many unanswered questions, especially about how to really use eccentric isometrics. It's not just a matter of, you know, maintaining a certain speed and holding the position. There's really so much more to it. And I wanted to do them justice and also your work justice because you did your PhD in this. So let's get into it, man.
For sure, man. Let's do it.
And if you're listening, again, make sure you listen to Joel's first episode because this will be a continuation. This will be a part two. So make sure you go back and listen to Dr. Joel Seidman's first episode on the secrets of strength training is what I'm calling this, Joel.
Nice. I like it.
And that's what I really feel like it is. There's so much misinformation out there. And then someone like yourself who works with all these athletes, NFL athletes and all the other different athletes that you work with, and you've also tried this out on yourself, it really is like a secret. So let's jump back into eccentric isometrics. We talked about the parameters. We talked about how many sets, how much time you take on the way down on the negative, the eccentric portion, how long you should hold it based on your goal for hypertrophy or strength. But I'd love to ask you about, this isn't just about doing a move at a certain speed, holding it. you have some very specific parameters about what you want to do or what you recommend people to do. Like, for instance, your article on ass to grass squats, as they're called, versus parallel. So could you explain a little bit more about how to use this technique and why we don't want to go all the way and relax at the bottom and count for five and then try to get back up?
Right, definitely. So yeah, that's definitely one of the common misconceptions. I remember when I first started talking about eccentric isometrics and writing about it a few years ago, had a lot of people, you know, writing into me or sending me videos and saying, hey, how's this look? And I noticed right from the get-go, they were showing me examples of movements where they would basically collapse at the bottom position, or they would use an excessive range of motion and hold the pause at that position. That is not an eccentric isometric. That is basically a reinforcement of improper mechanics because you're using an exaggerated or excessive range of motion that's not ideal for the human body. So for eccentric isometrics, for it to fall under the category of a proper eccentric isometric, it has to fall within the boundaries of what is considered proper human movement. And a lot of that goes back to biomechanics and to neurophysiology. When we're talking about feedback and muscle feedback and sensory feedback, which is one of the keys for eccentric isometrics, we want to get as much proprioception as possible, as much kind of information from our muscle spindles as possible, so we can fine tune our body position, we can have maximal kinesthetic awareness. Well, one of the key things that people don't understand about muscle spindles is that in order to maximize the feedback response from those intrafusal muscle fibers, we have to create a very high level of stiffness within the muscle. And again, that's not the stiffness that people commonly associate with in terms of, oh, this person doesn't have good mobility, or this person has a level of spasticity within their body. What I'm talking about is a high level of rigidity and motor control within the muscle itself, similar to, you know, when people think about doing a push-up on rings, for example. You have to have a high level of muscle stiffness to create stability. Well, muscle spindles aren't just activated in response to stretch. They have to be stretched, but they have to have a lot of tension within them. So when you go too far during a range of motion and you collapse, you lose that tension, you lose that stiffness, and unfortunately you lose that proprioceptive feedback that's so imperative for fine-tuning your body position. This is something that research has shown clearly, that basically an excessive range of motion, or motion that is significantly beyond 90 degrees perpendicular parallel motions, it breaches our body's natural movement barriers, and we decrease our proprioceptive feedback. Ultimately, we end up putting too much strain on our joints because we can't fine tune our body position like we need to.
Yeah, so important, because it's out there right now. It's a trend. It's in vogue that you got to bring that squat all the way down. People are always talking about how modern human beings have lost this ability to be in a deep squat position. But what you're talking about is the optimal position to produce force, to build strength. And you so eloquently explain the reasons why. But can you talk a little bit more about the squat? I think it's such a perfect example. When someone comes too low, you see their sacrum tuck under. You see that spinal flexion, that posterior pelvic tilt, whatever you want to call it. Can you talk more about that and how someone listening could make sure that they're dialing in their squat technique so they benefit from using the eccentric isometrics properly?
Right. Well, as you mentioned, that article, the ass to grass versus parallel squats, it got quite a lot of buzz and a lot of controversy around it, which is never a bad thing, obviously. But yeah, so I think one of the big distinguishing factors, and you kind of already hinted at it, is you have to differentiate between a standard kind of sitting, relaxed chair squat and a force-producing or athletic squat, which anything that involves strength training is going to fall under the latter category. It's something where we are trying to absorb force and we are trying to produce high levels of force with heavier loads or high impact. A third world squat, like you hear the ass to grass and you see, you know, people in Asia, and that they can, you know, hold these really deep squat positions and just sit there for hours and hours. That is not the same movement pattern, if you can even call it a movement pattern. It's not the same position or motion, or it doesn't even serve the same purpose as why we would squat when it comes to strength training. They are two entirely different entities, and confusing the two or interchanging the two, that's where we get into issues. Okay, so yes, everyone should have the capability, ideally, to be able to hold that really deep ass to grass kind of relaxed, ultra deep squat position that you see people kind of hanging out in Asia and different parts of the world. And even a lot of people in the US, they can hold that squat. Unfortunately, society, the way it is, people with posture, bad body mechanics, they can't hold that position. But as far as using that as something we try to incorporate into strength training, that's not ideal, because as soon as we start to move and produce movement, whether that's on the playing field, whether that's jumping, whether that's running, our body is designed to produce optimal force at 90 degree perpendicular parallel motions and joint segments. And as soon as we start to breach that, we not only start to put more stress on our tendons and ligaments and connective tissue, but movement transfers, okay? And this is something that I've been saying for a long time when I've been talking about the squat. And if you go back to motor learning, however we move in the weight room is going to be indicative of how we move when it comes to daily life, when it comes to jumping, running, throwing, kicking. If we're doing squats consistently with this ass to grass and ultra deep range of motion, what happens is it starts to reinforce those faulty mechanics and biomechanically inefficient positions into our central nervous system, so that when we run and we do all those other activities, instead of producing these optimal 90 degree or parallel or perpendicular joint segments that I keep referring back to, we're producing these excessive, exaggerated ranges of motion. And you start seeing people when they're running, they start overstriding. When they're jumping, they end up going too deep on the bottom position. They lose force, they lose torque, and they start producing a lot of tension on their tendons and ligaments. And this is how you see a lot of pulls, hamstring pulls, all kinds of stuff when people are running, because they're actually overstretching their muscles and their connective tissue and their joints and ligaments, because they've reinforced that idea of producing excessive range of motion when they're doing strength training.
I want to get back to this idea of joint mobility and stiffness and how eccentric isometrics may help improve that in a moment. But I want to ask you, so what you're saying, just so I understand clearly and maybe to reiterate for the listeners, even if you can squat past that where your thigh, your femur is below parallel and you can still keep that good spinal position because you have enough mobility in your hips and your ankles and your knees, that's still not what you want to do, because that's not the optimal way to train your muscles and your nervous system to produce force. Is that correct?
That is 100% correct. You probably summarized it better than I did. I probably got a little too esoteric there. But no, that's completely right on. And you see all this talk and discussion about individual differences and hip anthropometrics and, you know, hip anatomy, and, you know, everyone can squat differently. Well, that only represents and indicates what everyone's maximal range of motion is. And maximal range of motion is never the same as optimal range of motion, or rarely the same. Okay, so just because a person can produce this massive range of motion without any apparent kind of deficiencies in movement, or, you know, unusual kind of asymmetrical positions or any deficiencies, that doesn't mean that's their ideal position. When it comes to ideal position, it's pretty much the same from human to human. That's the field of biomechanics and motor learning and even muscle physiology. You know, when we look at the science of how the human body works, it's pretty similar from person to person. Again, those individual differences manifest themselves more so when you're looking at what a person's their maximal range of motion, their maximal joint position that they can get into, but that does not represent the optimal position. And when people do a squat with faulty mechanics, that's where you start to see these individual differences occur. So when somebody doesn't have optimal hip hinge mechanics, they don't set their hips back far enough, or if they don't have good foot and ankle mechanics, or if they don't have good spinal alignment, this is where you start to see these individual differences in mobility and range of motion occur. As soon as you teach someone to basically have good motor control, to tighten up their core, to have proper spinal rigidity, teach them proper hip mechanics, and then you teach them how to activate their feet properly with optimal ankle positioning, it's kind of funny, but you almost don't even have to tell them when to stop in the squat. They'll stop at around those 90 degree and parallel positions, because they know that in order to go deeper, they'd have to breach and get rid of all those other components that we just previously mentioned.
Yeah. And I want to get into that, because I loved your article on barefoot training. I tried all the drills in the article, which I'll link to in the notes for this episode. I want to talk about eccentric isometrics and mobility, and I want to make it a little bit more of a practical discussion, because, Joel, I tried exactly what you said. I'm like, this guy, I feel like he's on to something, which is why I wanted so bad to talk to you twice in a short period of time. And so I tried, like, I have a bad knee, you could say. I have chondromalacia. If I go, I can get away with doing, you know, a single leg squat or something like that, pretty deep, but I'm going to feel it afterward. And so I put your hypothesis or your methods to the test. And I started with a loaded single leg deadlift, Romanian deadlift. And I did it, usually I have to warm up my knees like most people would beat up joints. And I remember you saying a lot of the mobility stuff, the warm up that people use is becomes less necessary when you do this type of strength training. And so I didn't warm up, I didn't stretch, I didn't do my usual more mobility. I got away with doing it and my knee felt fine. So can you talk about why that happened and how someone listening could maybe improve their joint stability and improve their range of motion using the eccentric isometrics?
Right. Well, I guess two things there. So one of the things with the extended warm-up protocol, first off, if you're moving properly, okay, and you have good movement efficiency, good biomechanics, which eccentric isometrics help to produce and reinforce, then the need to warm up becomes less and less important and less necessary because you're not putting tension on the tendons and ligaments and joints and connective tissue. Instead, the muscles are in such proper, the joints are in such a proper position, the muscles are firing so effectively and so efficiently that they're absorbing all the force. None of that tension and trauma is going to the joints, okay? So that's a big part of it. So a lot of this, oh, I got to warm up, I got to, you know, get 10 or 15 minutes of all this mobility drills in, got to get a lot of blood flow. Well, the way most people move, I can understand why they do a lot of those warm-ups, because if I moved like that too, I'd probably have to warm up for an hour and get a crazy amount of blood flow to just kind of desensitize my pain receptors so I didn't feel all that trauma and impact on my joints. But with eccentric isometrics, not only does it reinforce optimal position and teach the body how to move correctly so that there's no tension on the joints, but the eccentric isometrics themselves, they're done in such a slow, methodical manner, and they're done without collapsing, and they're done with such a tight and rigid muscle and with such good spinal alignment that even if you're not warmed up, you can handle pretty heavy weights. I'm not saying that you should just jump into heavy weights, but I will do this periodically with myself just to kind of see how things are, because when you're not warmed up, it really does expose any little movement deficiency you may have. So if you have any type of pain, any type of inflammation, and you jump in and try and do a 315-pound squat, guess what? You're going to find out pretty quickly. So this is something that I actually do periodically with myself to kind of diagnose, hey, is there anything weird going on in my body? If I can jump in, which I pretty much can do at will whenever I want, and jump in and hit a pretty heavy squat without doing any warm-up and do it in an eccentric isometric fashion, I know that things are firing pretty good, and there's no risk for me doing that because I know that my muscles are firing in the right position. Again, that's not something I'm going to do with all my clients. And in fact, I will rarely do that. It's something that I kind of tell them they should be able to do. It's not something I'm going to test out on a frequent basis. And in fact, most people are not going to be wanting to do that. When I'm saying that's kind of what we need to get to in terms of such high level of movement that it becomes almost unnecessary to perform the warm up. Not again, that you shouldn't warm up, but it just doesn't need to be so excessive.
Got it. And that reminds me of something I think Pavel Satsaline said, where it's like, you know, tigers don't warm up, right? Exactly. Cheetahs don't warm up. They go, right? And, you know, I guess we live this modern life for so long and wore shoes since we're just, you know, less than a year old, which I want to talk about now, that we've lost a lot of that ability. And one more thing I want to say, oh yeah, let me say this as well. I use the eccentric isometrics, the parameters that you shared with me in our talks and also on your article. And I did it for ring dips, weighted ring dips. And man, I felt like, I didn't feel like I could, my my shoulder extension. So in other words, bringing for those of you listening, if you're standing up and your arms are at your side and you start to bring your straight arms up, you should be able to bring your straight arms up quite a bit, right? Some people say 45, some people say 90, but you should be able to get them behind you a little bit. And I just had so much easier time doing that. And I wanted to ask you before we talk about the barefoot training, because I think it's so important. You talk about the co-contraction of the antagonist muscles. And if you're listening right now and you're like, what is that? If you're doing a dip, you're using your pushing muscles, your triceps, the anterior, the front of your shoulders, your chest muscles. So the rear of your shoulder, the muscles in between your shoulder blades, you don't typically think of them as like, well, those are working too. No, you're pushing, you're doing a pushing movement. So those should kind of be turned off. And people talk about something called reciprocal inhibition. If you're a personal trainer and you've been in the biz for a while, but Joel, you say co-contraction of the antagonist muscles, the opposite muscles of the ones we're working. Can you talk about that more? And should we be squeezing? How do we get that co-contraction and why is it so important?
This kind of goes back to the ass to grass versus parallel squat. If I'm doing an ass to grass squat, what's happening is I'm pretty much allowing gravity to dictate my depth and my range of motion, and as well as my body mechanics and positioning. I'm just basically saying, hey, I'm just going to drop down, and wherever I stop, that's where it is, okay? We're not actually pulling ourselves into position at that point. And when we're not pulling ourselves into position with the opposite muscles and allowing gravity to dictate our movement, it becomes very sloppy, it becomes very uncontrolled, and we have a very low level of motor control. Research shows that high levels of co-contraction are imperative when it comes to motor control. So if we're talking about efficiency of movement and quality of movement, then co-contraction is huge. So now if we go back to something like a parallel squat, well, how do I do a parallel squat? It's not just about, oh, I got to stop parallel. No, I don't tell people, here's where you need to stop. What I do is I teach them how to use their opposite muscles to position their body. So when we say, get your hips back, hinge the hips, whether I tell them, hey, you got to flex your hip flexors so that you can extend and get the hips back, flex the hips. To get the hips back, they have to flex their hip flexors. There's no other way to do it. So, and then to actually get a little bit deeper, then they have to contract their hamstrings. But a lot of this goes back to co-contracting the right muscles, and that's what gets you into the optimal position. Again, you're not allowing an external force to pull you into position. You're dictating where that position occurs, and that's through co-contraction. And co-contraction occurs predominantly on the eccentric phase of a movement. So again, during a squat, or I'm contracting my hip flexors and hamstrings in order to pull me into position. Okay. But on the way up, obviously I'm firing my glutes and my quads, but that co-contraction happens on the eccentric phase. And then I release that on the concentric portion to maximize reciprocal inhibition. So reciprocal inhibition is essentially the opposite. I create this slingshot effect on the eccentric phase where both agonist and antagonist are firing, and then I release that, okay? So the higher I co-contract, the more I co-contract both muscle groups, the more tension I create, and then it creates this kind of a coiled spring or slingshot effect, and when I release that, my antagonist muscles fully relax or mostly relax so that my agonist or my main muscles can produce maximal force. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And you're using the squat, but I think an easy one, at least for me, is push-ups. It's amazing how many people who have shoulder issues with doing push-ups, then you say, well, pull your shoulder blades back as you come towards the ground. It eliminates, like, instead of just kind of lowering yourself, try to pull yourself with your shoulder blades. It eliminates a lot of people's issues. But Joel, are we trying to pull ourselves like that? Do we isometrically contract those muscles to cause more co-contraction?
Right. Great question. So I think, like you said, I think a chest press, an example, is probably a prime way to illustrate this. So even a bench press may be even a little bit easier to understand. But like you hear powerlifters talk about all the time, hey, you got to fire your back like crazy. You got to squeeze your lats, contract your back. And just like you mentioned, pull your shoulder blades together so you can get the right position. Well, basically that is co-contraction during the eccentric phase of a movement, okay? Mm. And then it creates that coiled spring and you get the maximal power or reciprocal inhibition on the way up. Now, as far as trying to conscientiously co-contract, okay? That's not something that you're really intentionally wanting to do. What I have my clients and athletes do, because that's something that I used to make the mistake of, is think, oh, I got to really try to flex and contract my opposite muscles and then I'll be good. What you need to do instead is try to optimize your body mechanics and your joint positioning, okay? And then when you do that, what you'll find is that you're actually contracting or co-contracting the appropriate muscles. So when I tell a client, hey, pull your shoulders down and back, pull your elbows forward, bring the bar slightly below the chest. And what ends up happening is they say, wow, I really feel my lats firing. Okay. And then they get that co-contraction. But if I tell them, hey, as you bring the bar down, go ahead and squeeze your lats, that actually does not work as well. It works better to coach and to basically facilitate optimal mechanics, and the optimal mechanics subconsciously produce that co-contraction that we need. And then if you want to maybe focus on squeezing your lats a little bit more, that's fine. But again, the mechanics are key, and that produces the maximal or ideal level of co-contraction.
All right, Joel, when's your next seminar? I got to be there, man. I got to go. No, but I love it. And I'm actually serious about that. I would love to get in there and do a hands-on with you sometimes. So many cool things to learn, even after I've been in the industry for so long. But it's so awesome to hear, like, oh, well, this is something new that you can learn and something to be better. And so what I hear you saying, Joel, and just to reiterate for the listeners, you got to get the position, you got to get the technique right. And the technique on exercises, it can be a little bit more complicated. And this is a huge reason why people aren't getting the types of results from exercise that they should be. It's just, you can't let your form, you can't be haphazard with your form or kind of okay with your form and having your elbows flare out like crazy on your pushing movements and swinging on your pulling movements. And yeah, it's so important. So it really comes back, you got to be a student of the technique. Strength is a skill. Every exercise that you do, it's like a martial art technique, or for the ladies or people who are into dance, it's a dance technique. It's a serve on a tennis court. It really is something that you need to kind of think about and master.
Exactly. No, and this almost kind of comes full circle. This is why I researched eccentric isometrics, because I kind of, you know, examined what's, you know, some of the kind of key components of optimal human movement. And then I said, okay, what can we do to facilitate all those and to create all those and to optimize human movement? Well, all those things we talked about, the co-contraction, optimal biomechanics, reciprocal inhibition. Well, eccentric isometrics are the single best tool that I have found to basically create that and facilitate it and promote it in your body so that everything is happening optimally in terms of ideal neurophysiology, ideal biomechanics, osteokinematics, joint positioning, and so forth.
Yeah, it's just really cool. I'm loving experimenting with them, and I'm getting some great results, and my joints are thanking you as well.
Nice, excellent.
So I think one other question, and then I'd love to jump into the barefoot thing. Eccentric isometrics, there's a strong eccentric part and holding the position. That can cause quite a bit of muscle soreness. What if you were more of an introductory person, maybe they're off the couch and they're wanting to do something, what would you do that's maybe a bit higher rep or higher time under tension, if you want to think about it that way, to prep themselves for working their way up into strength training with eccentric isometrics?
Let me back up just a second here and address the first part of what you just asked. In terms of muscle damage and eccentric overload, you know, there's all this research showing that, you know, you get that delayed onset muscle soreness from eccentric movements, and that the more accentuated the eccentric phase is, the more muscle damage you get. And for people that aren't as adapted to strength training or not as used to it or experienced, they're going to get even more, and it can become unbearable at times. So what I have found, and this is something that I've seen over and over again, I use eccentric isometrics as much, if not more, even in the early stages of training, because eccentric isometrics, they promote optimal body mechanics, like I mentioned. Well, optimal body mechanics, it does not produce nearly as much of that extreme delayed onset muscle soreness as what you would see as if mechanics were improper. So if you go to something like a bench press, for example, I remember even when I was training for, you know, had been training for 5-6 years when I was doing my undergrad in college, if I did my bench press and did accentuated eccentric movements and doing slow eccentrics, my elbows would flare out on bench press because I wasn't as efficient at the mechanics. Well, that would cause muscle soreness for anywhere from 4 to sometimes 7 days. Well, you can do an eccentric motion, a pretty heavy eccentric accentuated motion for that matter. And if your mechanics are ideal, if you're getting optimal co-contraction of the back muscles, and if your elbows are tucked, and if you have proper centration around the joint and equal tension across the various muscles that are supposed to be used, then actually you create very little muscle damage and delayed onset muscle soreness. So this all goes back to mechanics. And so I use eccentric isometrics almost predominantly with clients when they first start, because at that stage, it's even more important to make sure we're ingraining and reinforcing optimal mechanics. And I don't really have to worry too much about extreme muscle soreness because I'm making sure that the mechanics are proper. And again, with proper mechanics, the whole idea behind those extreme delayed onset muscle soreness bouts that people get, that's all based on faulty movement mechanics. So again, I have people do it at the beginning with eccentric isometrics as well as throughout their entire training. But we do maybe, we obviously go lighter, a lot lighter, and we often will hold for a longer time under tension to reinforce optimal mechanics, and so we can also clean up their movements.
Excellent, and very interesting. So if you're listening, you need to master the right position to start with. And if you're getting excessively sore from your exercise routine, you could be doing too much, even if you're using the right technique, but chances are you're not doing things correctly. You need to really master that technique and master what Joel's talking about. And Joel, in your first interview, you talked about for strength and power, 1 to 3 reps, 4 seconds on the way down, 2 to 4 second pause for hypertrophy or muscle building. You take 4 seconds on the way down, then you pause for 4 to 7 seconds and you shoot for maybe 4 to 5 reps. For beginners, what type of parameters would you recommend? What do you use with your beginners for the people listening who aren't ready to step up to the higher levels of loading?
Right. Well, I'm going to tell you what I use, and I'm going to have to kind of clarify this a little more. I use probably anywhere from 1 to 10 reps when I'm working with beginners. And let me give you a little bit more insight into that. Oftentimes, when you have a beginner and somebody who hasn't done strength training, or let's say they've done strength training for their whole lives, but they've just done it improperly. And I get this a lot with some of my collegiate and NFL athletes that I work with. We got guys coming to me and saying, hey, you know, I can squat 450 pounds. Like, let's do it. And I'm like, oh, hold on a second. Let's do a few body weight squats first. And honestly, after 2 or 3 eccentric isometric reps of proper squats, they are shot and they need 30 to 45 seconds of rest because their legs are on fire. And the level of focus and mental engagement that they had to produce and drive into that exercise was higher than probably anything they've ever had to do. So if I said, hey, we're going to do a set of 10 squats, guess what? It's going to be pretty much impossible for me to teach them proper mechanics. So oftentimes I will literally take it one single rep at a time. I'll tell the athletes, hey, give me one perfect rep. When they know they only have 1 or 2 reps, guess what? Their mental focus goes through the roof. They don't have to worry about sandbagging it, about leaving any left in the tank. They don't have to worry, hey, I got to save some energy for, you know, 10 more reps after this. They know that I'm looking for ultra high quality and they're going to give it to me because they don't have to worry about, you know, extreme fatigue building up. And also, I don't want the reps to be inordinately high because, again, with eccentric isometrics, we don't want to facilitate or reinforce faulty mechanics. As soon as fatigue starts to kick in with a beginner or someone who's not used to doing proper mechanics, their form is going to break down and they're going to have decreased proprioception. Again, this is something the research is showing. When you have increased fatigue and lactic acid accumulation and increased buildup of hydrogen ions, you actually desensitize your muscle spindles. And that's the last thing that I want for a beginner. Eventually, yes, we need to be able to work on all those different components and characteristics. So quality is through the roof. And if it takes 1 rep or 10 reps, because maybe it's easy for them and I can see that they can do 10 without fatiguing, and that's going to help reinforce the mechanics by doing more repetitions and more volume, then I'll have them do that. But I do whatever it takes to keep the quality as high as possible, again, whether that's 1 or 10.
Interesting. Yeah, so important. It's really interesting to hear that your high-level collegiate athletes come in squatting all this weight, then you have them do a bodyweight squat and they have issues with it. Yeah, I guess so many of us aren't doing things as well as we could. If you're listening, that is the big takeaway. Start dialing this in. Start using what Joel says, and I'll have the links to his articles up so you can read more. Joel, one thing I wanted to ask you, eccentric training, I read something about eccentric training and causing like temporary insulin resistance. Is that something you can speak on?
So this actually, I have an interview in Unconventional Athletes magazine coming out sometime in the next month, and I talk about how eccentric isometrics actually improve insulin sensitivity, and you know, they basically help to improve your body's ability to handle even carbohydrates. A lot of this goes back to overall physiology and how your muscles are functioning and firing. Well, our muscles are technically an endocrine organ. They were reclassified as an endocrine organ or endocrine tissue, I think it was less than a decade ago. So if you think about that, our muscles are the largest endocrine tissue or endocrine organ of the body. And if they're not functioning right, everything's off. Our physiology, our chemistry, our ability to optimize our hormones or endocrine function, all that stuff. So with eccentric isometrics, it optimizes our movement and optimizes the health of our muscles. And then we get this optimal crosstalk between muscles. And I'm not going to get into too much of this with the cytokines and myokines and how the muscles produce these different chemicals. But when you have too much delayed onset muscle soreness, like you said, it does impair insulin sensitivity. Well, like I said, with eccentric isometrics, it actually teaches you to properly absorb force during eccentric muscle contraction. And as a result, you don't get the same type of delayed onset muscle soreness, and you have better ability to basically handle carbohydrates, and you get better insulin sensitivity. So there's a little bit more in-depth science I can get into that. Some of it's actually, it's pretty detailed. But one thing that I have seen with clients, just from teaching them how to move properly, their ability to be able to handle more carbohydrates and have better insulin sensitivity goes through the roof. And it's something I saw with myself personally about 6-7 years ago when I started to improve my body mechanics with eccentric isometrics. I noticed I could handle way more carbs than I ever had. And I also wasn't getting nearly as sore, even though I was doing much higher frequency of training. So again, it all goes back to body mechanics, which again, eccentric isometrics help to produce those optimal mechanics. And then, you know, everything's functioning on all ends, from, you know, our digestion, upregulation of enzymes. I see this with clients all the time. They have better digestion, and their ability to basically break down nutrients goes through the roof once we teach them how to move properly. When they're not moving properly, it starts to mess with everything. Posture, and posture is related to poor digestion as well. So it kind of all ties back in.
Oh man, I guess we're going to have to do like a round 3, 4, 5 to get everything out of you, Joel. This is awesome, man. I love it. And I love how detail oriented and knowledgeable you are. There's so many people out there who are throwing out cool sounding sciencey terms, and they're not legit like you are. So thanks for being that person in our corner.
Well, appreciate it. Thanks for the kind words, man.
Well, it's true, dude. It's a nightmare sometimes. Even I've been in the business for so long, and sorting through the BS is a full-time job. Let's move on, though. I would love to get into that in a different episode, but I really want to dial into the barefoot training, because I tried your drills. I've been really into this for a long time. I've been working out barefoot for a long time. I've been working out at my house, at my home gym here, which is pretty minimalist. And I tried your drills and I love them. They're so simple, straightforward, and effective. And by the way, I did them before that was my warm-up for my eccentric isometric single leg deadlift. Can you talk about barefoot training, why it's important? Why, as human beings, wearing the super duper maximalist Nike Air Max with a pump to add more air in there is probably taking away from our ability and probably screwing up our knees, hips, backs, ankles?
Yeah, no, for sure, man. So the barefoot thing, it's a huge part of the training. And that's, I guess, another thing is to technically be classified as an eccentric isometric, it has to be done barefoot. And the reason for that is barefoot or minimalist conditions, it enhances neural drive to the rest of our body. Because if you think about it, neural drive and activation, really, okay, and innervation starts from the toes and feet and ankles and works our way up. And that's our point of contact whenever we're moving, when we're walking, when we're jumping, we're standing, squatting, whatever it may be. That's where we make contact with the ground. And there are a ton of sensory receptors down there, a lot of proprioception going on in our feet and ankles. And unfortunately, most people have blunted all that proprioceptive feedback because they've worn these shoes that basically allow their feet to essentially fall asleep and go dormant in terms of their muscle activation. And they have no feedback and their muscles start to basically get very lethargic and they don't have good control over their feet and ankles. And then as they're moving, they reinforce all these dysfunctional movement patterns in their feet and ankles from pronation, supination, fallen arches, flat feet, you know, the list goes on, cramped toes where they don't spread and splay like they should. So when people wear the traditional shoes that we've come to grown accustomed to as a society, unfortunately, it's one of the worst things that you can do for body mechanics. And it's something that I basically have to re-educate every athlete, not just in terms of, you know, explaining to them, but also teaching them via their nervous system and their feet and ankles how to reactivate their feet and basically fire their feet and ankles the way that humans are meant to use their feet and ankles.
Yeah, I love it. So we're all messing ourselves up with the shoes, even though they look cool, the new Nike Jordans or the Freeze or the metabolic, the Reebok Metcons or whatever it is, they're all kind of messing up your feet. And if you can work out barefoot, do it, get into it. I'll put the link up. We can't obviously really show the drills on, through audio or talk you through. It's not really going to make too much sense, but I'm going to have a link up to Joel's article on the barefoot training. It's something you should definitely get into and do, especially if you have any ankle, knee, hip issues. Joel, you know, I've been in martial arts for a long time. I've been working out barefoot for a long time. I just like being barefoot, but I started hating shoes when I noticed I've gone through so many different pairs and different types of shoes. Right now I'm wearing Reebok CrossFits, which is the closest I'll ever come to ever doing CrossFit. Not a hater completely, but just, you know, with our talk about movement mechanics and all that, it should be pretty clear where I stand. I'm on board with what you believe. My knees started hurting and they'll hurt if I wear my shoes and walk around too much. And when I take my shoes off and even walk around in the tile floor that we have here, the ache goes away like immediately.
Right. Yeah. No, I mean, part of that, it's, I guess it's almost, there's, you could almost break it down to three different components. So first off, when you wear traditional shoes, why shoes were designed to have a higher heel than the 4 foot, I will never understand. They could have designed all these shoes with the same amount of cushion, which is still not ideal, but why the heel is elevated an inch or inch and a half above the 4 foot, I'll never get that. But that it is what it is. That's how most shoes are designed. So if you think about it, you know, think about Olympic lifting style shoes. What are they doing? They're basically making the movement more quad dominant because it's pushing your knees forward more and you have more of an anterior knee drift and your body is tilting forward more onto the toes and you have less pressure through the hips. So basically imagine, you know, walking around like that, obviously not as extreme and not as, you know, much of an impact, but over time walking around, maybe even after an hour, you start to get a lot more pressure on the knee joints and you don't have equal distribution between the hips and the knees, which again, that is ideal. We want optimal kind of centration or tension between the two different portions of the body and lower body. Without or with the thick shoes and with shoes with heels, we don't get that. The other thing is when you're wearing these thick shoes, you don't have optimal activation. Your feet start to shut down gradually. When they start to shut down, you don't get optimal signaling and neural drive to the rest of the lower body and even in some ways the core and upper body. So your hips aren't firing like they should. And if your hips aren't firing, you're not getting activation in the glutes and hamstrings. So you're not getting the different types of co-contraction around the knee joint. And then finally, with shoes, it allows your feet to go to sleep, essentially like we talked about. So there's oftentimes a lot of pronation or a lot of internal rotation of the feet or external rotation as well. There's just a lot of things that can go amiss. And then you start to put unusual stress on the knee joints or the hip or the back for whatever it may be for different individuals.
Yeah. So shoes are terrible for you, but it's not received well when you're in the gym and, you know, you take off your shoes and your socks and say, you know what, I need to, you know, optimize my foot mechanics so I can lift heavy weights and be healthy. So it's not received well generally in public gyms and in private gyms. So what shoes do you recommend? I've seen you lifting in shoes. I've also seen you do barefoot stuff. Can you talk about what shoes we should be working out? What are Joel Seedman approved shoes for our workouts?
Well, it's getting a little harder and harder to find. This is actually something I discussed in one of my articles a while back, and it's becoming more of an issue. When the barefoot industry first kind of started to become huge, gosh, seems almost like a decade ago, there were a lot more companies producing barefoot style shoes, but then everyone started to get injured because people started to hop into this barefoot type training without preparing their feet and ankles like they should have. And that's why I wrote that article with all the exercises and drills and protocols to help people get to the point where they can safely and efficiently wear barefoot style shoes. So what happened is you see all these companies dropping their barefoot lines, or if they do produce barefoot shoes, they're not nearly as barefoot as they used to be. So New Balance used to be one of my favorite companies for that, and now they hardly produce any shoes. And in fact, I don't think there's a single shoe they produce anymore that I would wear, whereas 4 or 5 years ago, they were my go-to company. And then you have companies like Merrell, Scora, Barefoot, a lot of my clients and especially my athletes love. Nike came out, believe it or not, again, I'm not amazing, something like Nike coming out with a good barefoot shoe. They actually came out with a Nike Free Bionic 1.0. And if you take the insole out, like I have all my athletes do, and you order a half size smaller, it ends up being an awesome minimalist shoe. I mean, it's pretty close to barefoot, also holds up well. Merrell Vapor Glove. And also the Merrell Trail Glove, but the Merrell Vapor Glove is about as close as it gets to barefoot. You got about 2 millimeters of rubber under your foot and hardly any upper portion of the shoe, very lightweight, completely flat. So those are fantastic as well. Pedestal Footwear makes an awesome product. It's not necessarily a shoe. It's more of a training kind of glove or sock that goes on the foot. Awesome, though. You get awesome traction into the floor. It's not tight around the toe box. Your feet can fire like they should, but you know, this is actually something I'm trying to contact other shoe companies and talk to them about, maybe kind of helping to co-design a new barefoot shoe that's optimal, because there's less and less of them.
Wow, that would be awesome. I got a couple of connections. Let's talk a little bit more afterward. Maybe I can connect you with someone who might be interested in doing that. That's really cool. So yeah, the New Balance you don't like anymore. I'm going to have all those written down. You kind of fired off a few of them, the Nike Free Bionic, the Merrell Vapor Glove, and the Pedestal. I'll have that, all those links in the show notes, and you can pick out the best one for yourself. Do you not like the Vibram Five Fingers?
Interesting question. All right. So Vibram Five Fingers are cool. They're good. They are not my number one choice. All right. Now there's a few reasons for this. I've had clients express displeasure, not with me, with the shoe, saying how hard it was to get on their toes. It's almost like they needed pliers to pull each toe into the little shoe sockets for their feet to get into. So for some people, depending on the shape of their foot and their toes, it can be a little bit tricky. It can take, you know, 5 minutes to actually get your feet into those. Obviously, some people aren't a fan of how they look, but, you know, if you're into the whole barefoot thing, I don't think that's much of an issue anyways. One thing, though, that I did a little bit more investigation and research on this in the past. When you actually have something pulling against your toes constantly, it can actually start to distort your proprioception in your toes, and it can almost desensitize the proprioceptors. It kind of be like having something pulling against your arm all day and pulling it into the right position. It may get
it's
you
a stretch. Right. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's going to get you into the right position somewhat, but it's also not going to reinforce the idea of forcing that individual to use their muscle and their own nervous system to put their muscles and joints into that optimal position. So what I like to say with the five finger shoes is, if somebody is first starting off and they don't have good toe splay and their toes don't spread well, the five finger shoes are great to mix in periodically with another type of barefoot shoe. And when they go to another barefoot shoe or just simple barefoot conditions where they don't have something that's actually pulling their toes into the right position and forcing them to spread, they have to be able to intentionally, or even at the subconscious level, learn how to spread without something pulling their toes into position. So that's kind of where I am with those. And eventually I like people to get away from that so that they are basically producing the optimal mechanics intentionally on their own accord rather than having some external kind of device or shoe force them into those right mechanics.
Joel, you just really upset a ton of people in the biohacker and paleo communities because now they're not going to be able to say all the great things about their Vibrams and wear them on.
Just know. Vibram 5 fingers are infinitely better than any other type of non-barefoot shoe. But if we're talking kind of splitting hairs and what's the optimal barefoot shoe, I would have to put those few other ones I mentioned slightly ahead of the 5 finger shoes, but the 5 finger shoes are still awesome.
Okay. All right. Well, I love giving those communities a hard time anyway, but
yeah. You're about to, at my expense though, right?
What? Right. Yeah. Well, that was me, not Joel. You heard. So very cool. Yeah. And I was being facetious, but also pointing out like, sometimes we'll latch on to a good idea, like barefoot training, barefoot shoes, but we see something like the Vibram, which it's like, well, that's obviously the best because your toes are separated and they can work independently like Mother Nature intended, but that's not the case. Why? Hashtag science, right? And that's what you brought here today. So thanks.
Oh yeah, no problem.
Yeah. Well, cool. Joel, man, I just feel like we could go on for hours and hours. We could talk about the muscle physiology, muscles being an endocrine organ. I didn't know that, man. That's news to me. Very cool. We could talk about inflammation and the different chemicals and how to mitigate that, not just with exercise using eccentric isometrics, but perhaps a bunch of other things that you know as well, I'm sure, about supplementation and perhaps some other things. But I want to respect your time. I want to respect the listeners. But Joel, it's just a pleasure to speak with you, someone who's obviously like, this is your passion, your life. You're so into this. It's just a privilege to be able to speak with you. So thanks so much for coming back on.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on again.
Yeah. And if you want to check Joel's website out, advancedhumanperformance.com, go there. All the articles are there. Go crazy. There's a ton of information on there. He's got some great workouts on there as well.
Sorry to interrupt that one. Yeah. I do have a barefoot training manual coming out within the next few weeks. That's going to be probably the most extensive and comprehensive piece of literature on barefoot training there is. So that's going to be coming out in a few weeks.
Excellent. And by the time this goes out, it will probably already be out or close to being out. So if you go to advancedhumanperformance.com, you can check that out. Definitely get into that. If you have any issues with your ankles, your feet, plantar fasciitis, knee issues like I have, make sure you get that handled. Dr. Joel Seidman, thanks so much for coming back on. Man, I already want to get you back on again. Sorry to bother you like that, but I feel like you're one of the people who really have some great information to share that just isn't being, you're taking the time to really evaluate things and see what's best, not because of the marketing value, but because of its efficacy. So thank you so much. Wow. All I can say is I love my job. I love Legendary Life. I love being able to interview who I feel are the best of the best when it comes to optimizing mental and physical performance. And you've got pretty much both from Dr. Joel Seidman, although there was a heavy physical component. There was quite a bit in there on how to approach training on using certain techniques like blindfolded training or closing your eyes type of training to enhance the results that you're getting so that your body functions and feels better. Then once that happens, you can really push yourself and get all those great results, the strength, the muscle, the fat loss. So here's what I want to tell you. If you want to learn more about Dr. Joel Seidman, make sure you go to advancedhumanperformance.com. And that is really what he's about, advanced human performance. If you want to try a workout based on Joel's teachings, as well as Christopher Summers, the U.S. former gymnastics coach that I've had on the show, as well as many other people who have influenced me in my program design, exercise selection, and methods that I use, make sure you go to legendarychallenge.com. Join our free challenge. It starts Monday, the November 28th. Make sure you get in there. That can be the start of a health and fitness journey that takes you through the holidays, keeps you from putting on those holiday pounds, and sets you off right when January rolls around, when everybody is scrambling to get their new year, new you on. You'll already be rolling on the path, kicking ass and taking names. If you want that, join legendarychallenge.com. And if you'd like to try the workouts based on eccentric isometrics and some of the gymnastics moves that I use in my training, go to legendarylifepodcast.com/workout. You can buy the workouts there. And remember, we will be opening up CEO Strength, my coaching program, with all the revised workouts and the revised coaching app that will take your results to the next level. I mean, it's just going to be incredible. I want you to be excited for it. That's all I've got. Enjoy the rest of your week. I hope you enjoyed the bonus, and we'll talk soon.